If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The Taliban recently regained control of Afghanistan as US forces withdrew after two decades in the country. Following on from this seismic moment, back in September, we asked a panel of experts how history can help make sense of more recent events in Afghanistan. Our panellists for this discussion, in the order that you'll hear them speak, are Bijan Omrani of the University of Exeter, writer and historian William Dalrymple, Elizabeth Leake, who's Associate Professor at the University of Leeds, and the SOAS historian Rabia Latif Khan. They were speaking to BBC History Magazine Deputy Editor Matt Elton.
How much do you think that we need to understand the longer history of Afghanistan in order to make sense of what's going on at the moment?
I think it's vital. I mean, we think about the length of its history, and also a question very much in people's minds. Its history is a function of its location, its geography, and, I mean, to a certain extent, its ethnic makeup. And these things are all very, very important because I think they still play a very crucial role in the forces that are acting on Afghanistan as they did in the past and as they do to this present day. The idea that you have neighboring regions who, I think throughout history, have tried to treat Afghanistan as a frontier territory, and the fact that the geography of the region doesn't really offer them an easy territory to, or an easy line to be a frontier, is a real motor for the way that history has developed in the region and the way the conflicts have developed from that problem over the question of frontiers between centers of power. I mean, in the past, between Persia or Iran, between the Central Asian states and between India, and latterly between India and Pakistan, that conflict, which actually I think spills over into Afghanistan in a very complicated way.
Yes, I'd agree with all that. And I think it's true of anywhere in the world that you can't understand the present unless you understand the past. You don't know where you are unless you know where you've come from. But the history of foreign interventions in Afghanistan, which is obviously the hook for this discussion and the background against which we're talking, is one that haunts both the former invaders who came to a variety of unsatisfactory ends in Afghanistan, whether outright defeat or bankruptcy or humiliation and withdrawal, or the Afghans themselves, who have a very rich historiography of remembering these foreign interventions, and they look on, for example, the defeat of the British in 1842, or the defeat of the East India Company in 1842, rather, as we rather look on Trafalgar or the Battle of Britain. It's a foundational narrative of the state. And the diplomatic area in Kabul today is named Wazir Akbar Khan, after the man who massacred the Brits at Gundamuk and the holly hedge of Jagdalak in January 1842. And so, you know, what the Spitfire and what our brave boys of the RAF and all those sort of, you know, bag of nationalistic ideas mean to a patriotic Brit. The retreat from Kabul is to an Afghan, and it's totally present. And when the Taliban started making communications soon after Karzai was put into power, they said, "Do you want to be remembered as a son of Dost Mohammed?" In other words, the people who led the resistance against the British and eventually regained the government of Kabul. Or do you want to be remembered as the son of Shah Shuja, who was the puppet? Now, the point of that was that President Karzai was a direct descendant of Shah Shuja, like him, head of the Popalzai tribe. And so there's a whole variety of historical ghosts and ethnic fault lines which are completely visible and present for every Afghan who talks about this, and which is largely invisible to outsiders. And unless we understand those fault lines, both ethnic and historical, we are apt to fall into the sort of chasm that we've had in the last month.
So just to kind of throw in my two cents as well, I mean, I think without question, it's really important to think about and to trace Afghanistan's history to understand the current moment. But I think we also need to be very careful and nuanced as well in terms of engaging with Afghan history. I think one of the problems that I think has become particularly apparent and perhaps in Western media coverage of Afghanistan recently and certainly throughout the 21st century is a kind of a central focus on a series of sort of key tropes that people, I think, often widely assume sort of define Afghanistan's past. And I think what's really important, though, is to, in fact, recognize, I think both the vibrancy and the texture of Afghan history in the 19th and 20th centuries and before that as well, and to take a fuller and more expansive view of Afghanistan and Afghans and think about the ways that Afghanistan is not perhaps just an outlier. I feel like that's been too common of a trope recently in sort of discussions, and instead thinking about the various kind of political and social dynamics that have emerged in Afghanistan and its relationship with its neighbors and in its international relations. And I think only with kind of taking that more textured approach can we more thoroughly understand what's going on now.
Yes, I'd like to add a brief point here in relation to what Elizabeth said, which I think is very important, because I think we could also use the plural and talk about histories when we talk about Afghanistan, because of course there are the dominant official state narratives of the past, but if we look at historical marginal communities like the Hazaras, the same historical events may be understood in very different ways by different communities in the same country. So in seeking to understand Afghanistan's history, I think we also need to understand who is writing that history, who that history is being written about, and who may be overlooked in these historical narratives.
That idea of a multiplicity of narratives and histories is really important and really interesting, and I hope to get into some of that in a bit. One of the aspects of that is, do you think there are key events in this story that help understand what's happening now? And more importantly, I suppose, do you think there are key events that are often overlooked when we think about this history?
To just, I'd say very, very briefly, I mean, I think to kind of think about both what's being said now as well as Afghanistan's history, I wouldn't say, for example, I'm trying to think how best to frame this. I would say, I think we do need to pay better attention to events and developments from the 1960s through the 1980s, and particularly kind of the civil war that emerged in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And I really frame that as a civil war, not just as the Soviet invasion, because there were so many other dynamics at play during that conflict. Something that's really stood out to me in recent times is the number of comparisons that were made or have been made between the American withdrawal from Vietnam and the American withdrawal now from Afghanistan. But I think actually a better comparison or a better kind of more nuanced and important lineage is thinking about the events of the 1980s and the ways that those shaped dynamics in the 1990s and up into the 21st century. So I do think we do need to pay more attention to Afghanistan's 20th century history, which I feel like beyond, I suppose, a kind of key coterie of scholars who are really doing fantastic and important work on Afghan history, I feel like that period of time, the mid-20th century onwards, has not been explored or acknowledged adequately.
I agree. A lot of that hasn't really been taken fully into account. But I might broaden the idea of what needs to be looked at. And in terms of the attempts of Afghanistan to develop a coherent centralized state, or at least a state that functions. And I think you see several incarnations of Afghan government. I mean, certainly since the foundation of, the first Afghan empire in 1747, where you've got a matrix of problems which get in the way of, an orderly development of the Afghan state. So certainly earlier on, you have this problem that a big constituent of the first Afghan empire, especially the Durrani tribe. So the first Afghan empire is formed as the parts of the surrounding empires which are taken over by the Pashtun people under Ahmad Shah Durrani, and many of his immediate followers, his sort of big constituency, they seek many privileges for themselves. They don't want to pay taxes. It's very difficult to generate a line of succession for the monarchy. The state is very dependent on taking taxes from outlying provinces like Kashmir. And that just leads to instability. They can't build up a state whereby you legislate and you get all parts of people benefiting from the state paying into the state. And you get that problem recurring again and again. Afghanistan can't pay its own way. It can't generate its own income in the circumstances that it finds itself after that period. So that question of Afghan governance and ways that people have tried to generate governance in a very complicated region. So the Emir Abdulrahman Khan in the 1880s and 1890s trying this very, like Stalin, his nickname was the Iron Emir, rather like Stalin, the Man of Steel. He killed hundreds of thousands of people. He imprisoned many more. He moved people around the country in order to generate strong governance by using terror. But that all fell apart because he could not integrate into a wider international infrastructure or bring in new ideas, new technologies. So this problem of the failure of governance has recurred again and again. I think you might even look back to that late period of the 1880s, 1890s, where some of the problems that start to arise now can easily be seen with governance.
I think that's absolutely right. And in a sense, there have been far more periods of history when Afghanistan has not had strong central control than period when it has. And the period of the Iron Emir is an exception of a very, and Dost Mohammed perhaps another one, a period of very strong central control with orders being taken from Kabul in the provinces. And the Afghans are rather proud of this. There's a whole range of Afghan aphorisms about behind every hillock there sits an emperor and every man is a Khan. The idea that there are these sort of village governments which and local governments and tribal governments which have just as much weight as the central government. And while people will pledge their allegiance to a central government, they won't necessarily obey it. And you get this, and this is a feature of the historiography from the very beginning. The very first Brit to study Afghanistan, Mansur Joe Elphinstone, in the very first expedition, had a little line. He said that the internal government of the tribes answers its end so well that the utmost disorders of the royal government never even derange its operations or disturb the lives of the people. So I think the Afghans like to think of themselves as Yagistan, the land of rebellion. And you can look at the periods when strong central control has kept the country together, whether in a colonial form or whether in a domestic form, as very rare and exceptional moments in Afghan history.
So the next thing I want to talk about really is this idea of sort of dominant and overlooked narratives. Do you think there are communities within Afghanistan whose stories are either not told or that you think sort of mistold by the dominant narrative of what's happened in the country?
I can possibly chime in here briefly as someone who's worked with the Hazara community. It's very evident in my interactions as a researcher with the Hazara community that there are issues with how the dominant narratives of Afghanistan are discussed and the place of the Hazara community within these narratives. A very key example, some of the panelists have already mentioned the reign of Abdulrahman Khan, the Iron Emir. That was a very troubling time for the Hazara community. So basically what happened was a holy war was instigated by a king against the Hazara community, and they were labeled as being unruly, rebellious and disloyal to the king. And that's generally how it's portrayed in most accounts of Afghan history. But when you dig deeper, you find that many of his soldiers had been raping Hazara women in the central highlands of Afghanistan, where Hazaras are native to. And there had been multiple attempts of diplomacy when it came to the Hazaras and engagements with the king to help mitigate this and work together to bring this to an end. And this very much is ignored from the dominant accounts. And what we see is, rather than framing what Hazaras did as a resistance, they're portrayed as being a troublesome community who weren't willing to listen to the king. And that has implications in the present also, because you see a lot with members of the Hazara community I've engaged with, and you see it a lot on social media, that whenever Hazaras talk about their historic and current grievances, they're labelled as agents of Iran, and they're labelled as people who are not sincere to the state, and they're also told that, you know, they don't belong to Afghanistan and they should leave and go elsewhere. So I think the framing of past events obviously is can be very problematic depending on who you speak to. And it also has implications for community dynamics in the present, which is very evident in with regards to the Hazara community.
May I add to, I mean, that very important account from Rabia? I mean, certainly the Hazaras have been one of the sort of leading people who have been oppressed by this attempt by the Afghan state to centralize itself and to try to portray itself as ethnically and, I suppose, culturally more coherent than it actually is. And there are, I think, many others as well who suffered in this attempt to generalize a centralization. I mean, one people that spring to mind in particular are the people of what's now called Nuristan. It was originally called Kafiristan. I mean, both names which were applied to them by, I mean, the Afghan center. I mean, it's a very mountainous region in the northeast, now on the area that borders with Pakistan. And it had never been conquered by external Muslim forces. So Tamerlane in the late 14th century had tried to get into this mountain region, and he, I think he was sort of lowered down the mountain in a cupboard, and it just sort of all went wrong. He couldn't get there. And the region hadn't been Islamized. There were the culture which included animist worship, sacrifice, drinking of wine. And Abdul Rahman in the 1880s and 1890s made it one of the pillars of his mission to conquer this region. And he was enormously proud that he was able to do so. But, I mean, that came with great brutality and the extirpation of a culture there and forced Islamization. So he changed its name from Kafiristan, land of unbelievers, to Nuristan, which means land of light. And there was complete loss of culture and the capacity of people there to give an account of themselves, an account of their religion, an account of their history. And I think many other regions have suffered similarly with this attempt to centralize, to also Pashtunistize. So, I mean, the dominant tribal grouping in the south and the east, the Pashtuns, holding the levers of government, certainly in the late 19th and early 20th century, tried to extend their, not only their control, but their culture. This was done partly by migration, but also by trying to stop using other languages and to make Pashtun the only language to be used. So in that, lots of other narratives were denigrated, especially sort of Persianate narratives. And that is a tension which I think has always been present, certainly in the 20th century.
I think the deeper you go into any event in Afghan history, the more you find it has a completely different complexion when you look at it on a regional basis. The thing that I've studied, the first Afghan war, in the British accounts, you have this impression of a united Afghan resistance, these inverted commas fanatics that were attacking the British, and they're seen as an undifferentiated mass from behind the walls of the cantonment. But if you look at the different Afghan accounts of the uprising, you have completely different versions of what's going on, who's leading it and what's happening, depending on who's writing it, from which tribal group, at which end of the country. So the Aina Waqai has very much the version of what's going, from the eyes of Herat, which is completely different from the Akbarnama, which is Wazir Akbar Khan's sort of panegyric, and which again is completely different from the Jangname, which is the Kohistani version of events, where an obscure peer called Mir Masjidi, who barely appears in British accounts, is leading the entire uprising according to the Kohistanis. So this is just the one area I know very well, and I'm sure Elizabeth and the others will have examples from more recent history where different tribal groups and different ethnic groups from different ends of the country have completely different versions of recent history.
If we're talking about historical narratives and their prominence, one thing that's come up quite a lot in my discussions is the use of the terminology of majorities and minorities, which I find very interesting and is very relevant in the context of Afghanistan, because a lot of my research participants would mention that there's never been a census in the history of Afghanistan, so how can there be claims that certain ethnic groups constitute a majority and certain ethnic groups constitute a minority. And in the case of the Hazaras, the label of minority has been used a lot by non-Hazara Afghan communities. And I think it's very important to mention this because when we talk about narratives or agendas with regards to the Hazara community, it affects the power dynamics in the countries which remain unchallenged. And those who are perceived as ethnic minorities in turn can have less representation in governmental institutions, for example. And as most of the literature on Afghanistan's ethnic communities labels Hazaras as making up 10% of the country's population, when they themselves will say they make up 20 to 25% of the country's population. And the relevance of this point to the present time that we're in is, you know, for those who might be aware, the Taliban cabinet was recently announced, and of the 33 members, there wasn't a single Hazara. And that means there's no Hazara representation in the new government, and there's also no Shia representation in the government. So that's how these historical narratives can actually have an implication on present circumstances of different communities in Afghanistan.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So it's not that empires have not succeeded in Afghanistan. It's that Western colonial empires in recent times have found it very difficult to rule Afghanistan.
I want to talk a bit now about religion, because one of the aspects of this story that gets talked a lot about is religious fundamentalism. Is it reductive to see this as being a key and sort of recurring part of this history?
I would say to put it very bluntly, I would say yes. I think focusing on the idea of religious fundamentalism, I think in a lot of ways is really problematic. And I think it's extremely reductive. And I think it provides a far too easy sort of analytical tool or trope to use to dismiss both not only religious, but also social and political dynamics within Afghanistan across time and space. I don't think that there's any question that certainly religion and Islam have played an important role in Afghan history, but it's not in any sort of singular form. I mean, we can certainly think about how different local leaders have used Islam to assert their own standing within local communities. But equally, I think if we think about events in the 20th century and the rise of the Islamist parties that became, I think, kind of in the Western media in particular, kind of the forefront of the Mujahideen, the Afghan resistance in the 1980s, I think to describe even their sort of ideologies and aspirations as religious fundamentalism is problematic and misleading, because it really ultimately ends up undermining or disregarding the fact that these various kind of religious political leaders had very fundamentally modern aspirations. And I think we have to really recognize that point and then think about how different communities and different leaders and elites and intellectuals, yes, have engaged with Islam and wrestled with its social and political meanings, but have done so in numerous ways and sometimes competing ways, etc. And I think Rabia's point as well too brings up the point that we have to recognize as well sectarian differences as well as sort of trans-sectarian alliances. So I think just focusing on the idea of religious fundamentalism is misleading and it's reductive, and I don't have a lot of time for it in a lot of respects.
I'd entirely agree with Elizabeth, and I think the what is true of Afghanistan is true of much of the region, that Western eyes see this as a problem of, quotes, Islamic fundamentalism, when there's a whole ragbag of different things going on, which are often misinterpreted as religious fundamentalism, in inverted commas. In many ways, what I think happened in the last month has strong parallels to what happened in Iran in 1979, where you had what on the surface looked like a religious revolution, which certainly brought a religious figure in Iran to power. And the Taliban see themselves as an Islamic emirate. But behind that lay a whole bundle of social, cultural, and economic grievances. Why were people rising in Iran against the Shah? It was partly the secret police, partly because of the corruption of the ruling class, partly because of the way that most of the country was not benefiting from the Shah's rule, and the small elite were plundering the country in the eyes of the rural conservative masses. And I think a lot of those factors were to blame for what happened in the last month. There were a lot of people in Afghanistan who felt the small elite in Kabul were devouring resources that were being poured in. And it was very striking when you went to Afghanistan any time in the last 20 years that despite the however many trillion dollars were supposedly arriving in the country year in, year out, there wasn't even a single road in the country that didn't have potholes. Even from the road from the airport to the presidential palace was like a back road in Delhi. So a lot of people felt that this was a matter of justice against injustice, a decadent minority against a worthy the people in the villages who were missing out, and also just a general conservatism in the face of rapid development and the word you hear again from supporters of the Taliban is this idea of justice, the idea that there was no justice in the old regime. It could be bought. It was only justice for the rich. The poor had no access to this. So whether or not one accepts that rhetoric, there's no question that Islamic fundamentalism, as perceived from the West, is a very, very small part of a much more complicated picture of grievances and motivating factors.
And I think, Afghanistan, Islam is part of a very complicated matrix of other factors which go in to make up people's identities, which people resort to in times of stress. So, you might think of a local identity, an identity linked to an ethnicity, and then Islam might appear at the top of that as another identity to which you have to go to if you feel threatened, and that becomes a sort of unifying factor or a factor that can be used to motivate people in order to take up a cause. So I think one has to bear that in mind. There are many sort of interlocking things which need to be taken into account.
One of the narratives that gets told about Afghanistan is that it is what's called a graveyard of empires. Is that true? And what do you think the reasons for that are, if it is true?
So there have obviously been many, many empires which have ruled whole or parts of Afghanistan perfectly successfully. If you go back far enough, the Kushan Empire had its capital under Bagram Air Base and full of treasures of gorgeous Roman glass and beautiful Indian ivory furniture and beautiful gold objects. And it ruled deep into Uttar Pradesh and India from there. Various medieval dynasties, most famously the Lodis and then the Mughals. Kabul was the base for Babur's invasion of India. Kabul proved an extremely lucrative base for Babur. Then again, other Timurid empires of Shah Rukh in Herat and so on, presiding over a golden age of painting and architecture and colleges and education, Gohashad, Bizad, all the great names of Western Afghan history. So it's not that empires have not succeeded in Afghanistan. It's that Western colonial empires in recent times have found it very difficult to rule Afghanistan. But that said, as we've been discussing, so have most domestic Afghan rulers found it difficult to rule Afghanistan. It's not a problem only faced by colonial rulers, and we are seeing signs even now that the Taliban are going to have a lot of trouble extending their authority or maintaining centralized authority. They're fighting among themselves. We've heard of. There's still continued resistance in Panjshir and demonstrations around the country. So it is a difficult place to rule, full stop. It's not only colonialists who've had that problem. And so, history is full of very successful empires which have ruled Afghanistan. But it's certainly true that the East India Company, the Raj, the Russians, and the Americans all left with a bloody nose, though none were defeated outright. And this is the point Bajan was making earlier. It's that the real problem is that Afghanistan can't finance its own colonization. If you invade Bengal, there are two harvests a year, there are spectacular natural resources, and there is an extremely rich merchant and middle class. You can tax, and you can use that money to recruit soldiers, and you can make a profit out of colonialism, as the British and the East India Company very successfully did, particularly if you bring opium into the trade and turn yourself into a narcotics empire run on selling narcotics to China. More recently, the East India Company, which was making a massive profit out of its operations in Bengal and Bihar, suddenly went into the red when it invaded Afghanistan, because having to support an army in a very distant place from its center of operations, transport food and weaponry over vast distances with the entire Sikh army between you and your base, and build forts and roads, is an extremely expensive business. Later on, with the Russians, it famously broke the Soviet economy, or helped break the Soviet economy, at the cost of continual fighting in Afghanistan. And finally, now with the Americans, it wasn't in a sense that they'd actually been militarily defeated, and that the Americans could not carry on resisting the Taliban. That it was domestic politics found it too expensive, both in terms of cost and body bags, and the fact that it just simply seemed to go on forever. And eventually, just Joe Biden made the decision to pull the disastrous decision to pull the plug. But it wasn't actually a defeat. So it's the cost and the difficulty of financing it, as Bijan said earlier, rather than the outright military impossibility of governing it, that in the end seems to cause all these different empires to come to grief.
Do you think that, we're obviously talking in Britain here, do you think that we need to understand the British Empire's involvement in this story more fully, and perhaps think about what it says about our own history, as well as that of Afghanistan?
My view, to add to what Willie says earlier about the impact that the British-Afghan wars have had on Afghanistan, and the feelings that Afghanistan feels towards the outside. I mean, I think one of the most important long-term impacts that still has a huge presence to this very day are the frontiers that Britain essentially imposed on Afghanistan in the course of the late 19th century. Britain was responsible for the drawing of the northern frontier with the then Russian Empire along the Amudarya River, which is best known in Britain as the Oxus, but also, more famously, the Durand Line, which forms the it's nearly sort of 1,700-mile long frontier between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And that frontier was really drawn up. It was drawn up in 1893 with the cooperation, a very grudging cooperation of the Iron Emir, Abdul Rahman. He recognized it would be good to have a clear demarcated frontier between Afghanistan and the British Empire in India, because he could then say, I'm going to try and control this bit with all of my might on my side. But the frontier was really drawn up with the convenience of the defense of British India in mind. And it cut through Pashtun peoples. It divided sort of tribes, villages in half. And the frontier since then has just been a deep bone of contention between Afghanistan and its neighbor. So originally British India, but later on Pakistan. And the feeling that the Pashtun peoples, who in the Pashtun narrative were the foundational tribe of Afghanistan, because they were the ones who used their military power to conquer their neighbors and develop the state. They feel that their people were cut in half by this line, and that they should not be on the side of Pakistan. They need to be reunited. And Pakistan, of course, who has this existential fear because it's this sort of group of provinces brought together, and they fear any part of their nation being lost. So they've always been very worried about this irredentist idea that bits of the Pashtun areas would go back into Afghanistan. If they lose that, will they lose Balochistan or Kashmir? And that's always led to this very hostile attitude between the two countries. And certainly in the 1960s, there was a moment where Pakistan shut down the frontier. I mean, there had been sort of military conflicts and so on. And Afghanistan at that moment was unable to export its goods, and it was thrown back into the arms of the Soviet Union. And it was from this period that Soviet influence really began to develop in a very strong way in Afghanistan. And so that's just a lingering footprint of the imperial impact, where Britain developed a frontier that was really good militarily for its defense, but no good for the surrounding nations, and it threw Afghanistan back onto the arms of the Russians. And that, of course, leads to the events of the Soviet invasion and the civil war in the 80s. And the problems with the frontier are still felt today.
No, just a very brief point. Bijan basically said it, just about the current issues that still persist with that border because of the border tensions, Pakistan saying that that's its western border and Afghanistan not acknowledging it as a border. People's livelihoods on both sides of that area are impacted very regularly because when there are border tensions, the border is closed on the Pakistan side. So traders are impacted and people who have families on both sides of the border are obviously regularly impacted by that. So, a legacy of the British Empire going back 120 years ago has quite severe implications for people living in that region now.
Just to follow up on Rabia's point too, I think there are kind of just two other really brief points I would also want to bring in into this conversation about, I suppose, the legacies of British imperial engagement with Afghanistan, but also suppose, I mean, this is part of a broader global story as well. I mean, I think firstly is kind of are the British the legacy of British colonial framing of Afghan politics and society as tribal, and how in British imperial usage, the word tribe kind of expanded to mean not just a certain type of kind of patch of kind of kinship ties or kind of social organization, but how the term became increasingly used pejoratively or to imply that a society was backwards or incapable of governance or so-called civilization. And that's certainly, I think, one of the key reasons why we keep talking about Afghanistan as being tribal. That is a consequence of British imperial terminology and British imperial engagement with Afghanistan. But also, too, I mean, that's a term that then has also been used globally thanks to colonialism, but again, has these kind of implicit backwardness or kind of this kind of assumed backwardness and of communities that are called or termed as tribal. So that's one point. And then I think the other point that I think we need to remember too is thinking about kind of British influence on the power dynamics within Afghanistan, and specifically so many of the historical narratives that have focused on ethnic Pashtuns within Afghanistan. And I think these are points sort of that Rabia and Bijan have both touched on to some extent, but thinking about, because British colonial officials placed so much emphasis on the ethnic Pashtuns that they encountered, I think that's one of the key reasons as well why, I suppose, maybe scholarship hasn't caught up, and I think, or popular conversations also perhaps have not caught up so much on recognizing Afghanistan's fundamental diversity, as well as recognizing the multiple experiences and histories of those other communities, and kind of recognizing that Afghanistan, like any other state, is you know, multi-ethnic, and it has this diverse kind of this diverse population.
Can I just add one point to that on the question of power dynamics? I mean, I think all of that's quite right, and I mean, one reaction which certainly was very evident, I mean, following the first Afghan War, very much in the time of Abdul Rahman and beyond, was a sense in Afghanistan that, very much propagated by Abdul Rahman, that we are hemmed in by Western empires. We have the British Empire, which is a non-Muslim empire, to our south and east. We have a Russian empire, again, a non-Muslim empire to the north. And, I mean, you have a Shia Persian policy on the west. And there was a sense in Afghanistan that it was the last unconquered Islamic territory. And it's a response to that sense of being hemmed in by these imperial presences was a developing isolation and a fear of actually developing itself or engaging with or taking any of the technologies of the surrounding empires for its own benefits. And that went on for a long time. So Abdul Rahman, he didn't want to develop roads or rail links in the country because he thought that that would make the country more attractive for invaders. And he was very, very hesitant about the idea of bringing in new educational ideas into the country because that could destabilize the order that he'd managed to develop or his interpretation of Islam that he was using as a tool to hold the country together. And, I mean, the isolation had been developing partly because of the collapse in trade routes, which, again, was a consequence of developing imperial presence and development of sea routes, thanks to the British Empire and overland Russian trade routes. But, I mean, with this development of the imperial presence in Afghanistan's borders, there was just an isolation at a vital moment, which meant that it fell behind in terms of the development, material development that it could offer its people. And it's sort of been very difficult for it to catch up with that and get over the fear that development equals a surrender of or sovereignty or a danger to sovereignty.
Do you think that what's happened over the past sort of month or so in some way signals the end of the American century?
My feeling is that it's certainly adding to the impression that American influence is diminishing. As we all know, China has been very active with the Taliban. The Mezainak copper mine is due to reopen. Three times now, the Taliban have made televised announcements about how China is their best friend. And China has offered in recent days to supply vaccine. They're talking about including Afghanistan in the Belt and Road project. And yes, there's a very strong impression. I mean, you know, it's early days yet and things may not work out as planned as they often do not in Afghanistan. There is a very strong feeling that American influence and hegemony over Afghanistan and maybe also Pakistan is diminishing fast, and that the Chinese are replacing them as the principal allies of both countries. And they've chosen a very different model to the American model of installing a puppet and trying to puppeteer a liberal democracy. They're offering loans. They're threatening. They're offering to build infrastructure and road networks, and to become a major economic partner in return for a mineral extraction. And that may be a deal that the Afghans can live with. Famously, some of the more successful invaders in history who dealt with the Afghans did so by paying them. Nadir Shah going off to raid Delhi in 1739 from Isfahan paid the Pashtun tribes on the way out, and he paid them on the way back again and got his loot home. That may well be a model that works. So yes, I mean, it's obviously far too early to say, but it does feel, I mean, there's obviously been no question of the rise of China's economy over the last 20 years has been astonishing, and the speed with which it has not only developed itself, but it extended its economic influence over many, many parts of the world, including Africa, including Pakistan, including Sri Lanka, the growth of the string of pearls through the Indian Ocean, the deep water ports, the places where Chinese nuclear submarines can base themselves, is the principal geopolitical change in the world in our lifetime. And the impression is that the last few days has speeded up that process, as reflected by today's headlines that Britain, America, and Australia have a new defensive pact aimed, obviously, against China. So yes, I do feel that this is not a new thing. This is this has been going on for two decades, but it feels like an acceleration. Yeah.
Finally, when people look at those headlines, or when they think about the history of Afghanistan, what stories and what narratives and what new ways of thinking would you like them to bear in mind in the future?
I mean, I feel like there are so many, I suppose, histories of Afghanistan that have yet to be told. And I think particularly if you think about kind of comparatively, we've referenced South Asia and the British Empire in South Asia. I think particularly if you compare histories of Afghanistan or Afghans to those of India or Pakistan, I mean, there are so many fewer histories. But I think that has a lot of consequences then for the sort of knowledge that keeps getting recycled around Afghanistan. But I think one of the points that I'm really keen to bring forward or to reemphasize is, I think, firstly, that Afghanistan, particularly in the 20th century, has had a fundamentally global history. And I don't mean that in terms of being this so-called graveyard of empires, but in terms of the ways that Afghan political elites and intellectuals have always thought globally and have acted worldwide. So Afghanistan was a member of the League of Nations. It was an early joiner of the United Nations. And it was an active member in other major international political organizations in the 20th century, like the Non-Aligned Movement. So I think in that respect, it's important to recognize that, especially in the 20th century, Afghanistan is not an outlier to the international system. You know, and it certainly sat alongside other Afro-Asian countries in terms of, you know, taking part in the fight against colonialism, in kind of pushing forward struggles for decolonization, and in taking part in sort of international discourses around human rights and the rights of states. So I think the fundamentally modern aspirations of many Afghan elites and intellectuals and communities is something that's really been overlooked, both in the scholarship and in kind of broader dialogue. And I think as a consequence, that serves to sort of reemphasize instead these narratives of Afghanistan as somehow exceptional. And so I think we need to question that exceptionalism and to further reintegrate Afghanistan's stories and past, not only to our modern thinking, but into histories of the international system in the 20th century, as well as into histories of South and Central Asia.
I'd just add a brief point about going back to our earlier conversation about religious fundamentalism and religion. Obviously, the Taliban are only one segment of society. They don't represent the whole of Afghan society and thinking. And when we talk about Islam and Muslims in Afghanistan, we need to be aware or to understand that Muslim Islam in Afghanistan is not a monolith. There are various Muslim communities. Sufism was practiced historically in Afghanistan. You have sizable Shia and Ismaili populations as well. So I think the need to not see Islam and the Muslim communities in Afghanistan in such black and white terms, and understand that there's more nuance needed when we look at religion in the context of Afghanistan, and even the acknowledgement of the country's pre-Islamic history, which a lot of people aren't aware about, the Buddhist and Zoroastrian history of Afghanistan. Afghanistan was a center of Buddhist learning, and unfortunately now the non-Muslim communities of Afghanistan are dwindling, but there were thriving Hindu, Sikh and Jewish communities also. So that's something to bear in mind, I think.
Yes, I mean, what I was going to say follows on very nicely from what Rabia said, and it's just two little vignettes. Firstly, a reminder that Afghanistan, until the 1980s, was a wine-producing country, until the Mujahideen blew up the plants. Sir Thomas Holditch, the British geographer, describes Afghan wine as a muddy sort of Chablis, but the greatest person to appreciate it was Babur, the conqueror of India. And this vision of this great Muslim monarch sitting in the gardens at Kabul, which he so loved, drinking wine and improvising poetry, it's an illustration of what Rabia says, is that the way that Islam was practiced and people's approaches towards Islam are not what people expect and are very varied throughout Afghan history. And just to add to that, who built the biggest Islamic college or foundation in the west of the country, in Herat? It was a woman, a lady called Gohar Shad, in the Timurid period. And it was under female patronage that Islamic scholarship flourished. And it's those two points, that Islam isn't a lot of bearded men telling people to stop doing things. Islam in the country is a creative, mystical, spiritual, artistic, full of dance, music, and philosophy. And I think that that's something that needs to be remembered as much by the Taliban in Afghanistan as outside the country as well.
Our panellists for today's discussion were William Dalrymple, Rabia Latif Khan, Elizabeth Leek and Bijan Omrani. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us again tomorrow when Christina Ezrahi will be sharing the story of one of the most famous ballerinas of the Soviet era.